This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Joe Prendergast on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, great to have your company right around WA on a Wednesday afternoon. A busy program for you. A rail safety bill will be debated in Parliament this afternoon. So just after the four-day weather forecast, you'll hear why this is so significant for Lara Jensen, whose family runs a station near Mount Magnet. Before then, you'll hear about a teenager who accidentally ran over 15 cows on the weekend. And you're also going to hear about Mount Mackie. It's a property between York and Northam. And you'll hear why a retired rural doctor is now spending a lot of her time restoring the woodlands in that area. Those stories very soon. Just wanted to let you know, though, about a new bushfire watch and act that is in place now in the Shire of Broome. It's for people at Barnhill Caravan Park and Barnhill Station in parts of Roebuck, which is in the Shire of Broome. The alert level for this fire has just been upgraded and there is now a possible threat to lives and homes in that area. So the fire is burning west of the Great Northern Highway. It is burning towards Barnhill Caravan Park. It's moving in a northwesterly direction and it is not contained or controlled. So firefighters and pastoralists are on the scene actively fighting the fire. The warning area has been extended north to include the Yarru Indigenous Protected Area. If you need more details on any of that, just search the Emergency WA and you'll see the details there. This Bushfire Watch and Act is at the top of the homepage on the Emergency WA website. So just repeating, a new Bushfire Watch and Act is in place in the Shire of Broome. It is for people at Barnhill Caravan Park and also Barnhill Station, which is in parts of Roebuck. Jump on the Emergency WA website for more details on that fire and what you should do if you are in that warning area. Well, the WA Grains Group says new rules which set a six-fold reduction in the workplace exposure limit for phosphine gas could decimate the state's export grains trade. Phosphine is the single most relied upon fumigant to control pests in Australian grain in storage. But there are concerns about phosphine's impact on human health, and Safe Work Australia has set some new workplace exposure limits. The WA Grains Group has written to WA's WorkSafe Commissioner, appealing for more time before the new rules come into effect because they're currently scheduled for December 1st. WAG Chair Alistair Falconer says industry needs more time because, as they stand, the new rules make phosphine basically unusable.
So my understanding is that the workplace exposure limits are being dropped from 0.3 to 0.05 parts per million over an 8-hour period, which is a massive decrease. And also the short-term limits, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, have been reduced, you know, 6 to 7-fold as well, which is concerning because I'm not sure that it's actually equipment that can measure that in the first place, such low exposure limits.
When you think about the practicalities of storing grain, both on farm storage and also in a bulk handler setting, when you have such a significant reduction in the amount of phosphine that a person can potentially be exposed to, what does that practically mean for that stored grain and how you store it?
It almost renders phosphine unusable, the way I understand it, because the limits are so low that you couldn't use it to be safely exposed, which would make it really hard to store grain, full stop.
What does that then do when you think about WA's export grains trade? Does that create a risk there in terms of the quality of the product that WA needs to be able to deliver to its end customer?
Absolutely, because to reduce the exposure limits enough, you'd have to air the grain out for so long that it would make logistics a nightmare, and also, you know, leave it open to you know, pests coming back into that grain. So I'd imagine, you know, for exporting grain, it'll be a complete nightmare.
And it's a big call, what you're saying, that this reduction in the amount of phosphine that can be used could decimate our export grains trade. That was the wording from your letter to Sally North. Do you think you're overstating it there, or is that really the reality here?
Well, I think from my point of view, that is the reality, because there is no other fumigant that I'm aware of that is as effective as phosphine, you know, currently available. So it is of a massive concern, yes.
And how much of the WA crop would be treated with phosphine at some point?
That's a good question, but I'd say it would be, you know, certainly the cereals all would be treated at some point. If Australia goes down this path, we would have the lowest exposure limits, you know, in the Western world. You know, if you look at the US, Canada and the like, their exposure limits are where ours currently are now. So it's a bit hard to understand why SafeWork Australia wants to reduce it even further.
But it comes from somewhere, doesn't it? I mean, SafeWork Australia hasn't just made this up. There's obviously a reason for it. Does that need to be considered? Because someone listening to this might go, well, you're just ignoring that there's potentially a human health concern here.
Yeah, you're probably right. So I think the best thing that could happen is that there was a three-year pause on this regulation coming in so that the industry can adequately research and make sure that what we are doing is safe for everybody working, you know, in the grains industry.
And you have written to the SafeWork WA Commissioner, Sally North, today asking for that time. Is it so that industry can prepare and work out how it can be compliant, or is it to try and get more time to make the case that these rules are unworkable?
I'd say there'd be a bit of both, but probably more to show that, you know, these rules are unworkable and current levels, you know, seem to be, you know, fine for human exposure at this stage.
And have you been in discussions with CBH about this?
We haven't as yet, but GTA are involved in talks to get the three-year extension and the research done with GPA and other organisations.
WA Grains Group Chair Alastair Falconer, I wonder what you make of all of this. If you use phosphine on farm, in your stored grain on farm, can you comfortably comply to these new maximum exposure limits? Or do you agree with Alastair where there is a risk that phosphine basically becomes useless? You can't really get any value out of it. Let me know on text, the number 0448 922 604. These new maximum exposure limits are set by a national body, but then implemented by the state bodies, which is why the WA Grains Group is writing to WA's WorkSafe Commissioner. But in the east this week, WorkSafe Victoria has said that it won't enforce the new phosphine restrictions until December 2029. So they've put out a three-year delay in actually putting in these new standards, and Alastair Falconer is hoping WA follows suit. You heard how Alastair was saying how concerned his group is about the impact of these new phosphine rules on WA's export grain trade. So I did ask WA's main grain handler and exporter, the CBH group, what its position was on these new phosphine rules. No one was available for an interview, but they sent a statement which says CBH supports evidence-based worker protections and is working constructively with industry, regulators and government on the proposed workplace exposure limit changes. These proposed changes are significant, and if they are determined to be necessary based on scientific evidence, they need to be implemented in a way that is safe, practical and supported by reliable monitoring. That is the statement from the CBH group. I'm keen to get your thoughts on this one this afternoon. New phosphine maximum exposure limits due to come in on December 1st, and a really significant reduction in the maximum amount of phosphine that a worker can be exposed to. Some concern from the grain industry about what it means for stored grain into the future. But let me know what you think this afternoon. The text number 0448 922 604. Bulk handler GrainCorp has also joined the conversation, calling for change to the looming new phosphine restrictions. Josh Connell is the head of supply chains with GrainCorp. He says complying with the new rules would be very difficult and impractical.
What the bulk of the changes do is adds time, and so we found situations where a bunker that we would previously ventilate in about 2 days, now taking up to 40 days. And so that impacts your speed to market. And for Australia, you know, we're really competing globally to get our crop out in that first 5 to 6 months to beat the Northern Hemisphere crop. And so what this does is starts putting that at risk, which in turn rolls back to money into farmers' pockets. The other unique challenge with this one, though, is that they've set the limits so low and so far below where they are globally, there's not actually any testing gear available that in real time you can put on the worker that can accurately measure it. And so what is out there, unfortunately, has a high level of cross-sensitivity. Anything from diesel particulates to mandarin skins to even to your breath can alarm it. And with the introduction of a peak, what that means is that if I get one of these really low levels in my workplace and apply to others, you know, I've then got to take action, which means that from a GrainCorp perspective, and this won't affect harvest, and I want to be really clear with that, is it's not going to necessarily slow down the speed of reservoir harvest. It's about getting it out. But I might be shutting down a sample stand, or I might not be able to operate a site because when I'm fumigating the exclusion zones, or if I get a detection of phosphine in a sample stand, I'm going to have to send everyone home, make sure they're okay. And that means it stops, and then that adds cost, and that impacts everyone.
So with those bunker ventilation times, you said 40 days. So does that mean if it's been fumigated, it might be at least 40 days before the grain in that bunker can be handled?
Yeah, 100% before it can find its way to market. And so, you know, again, time is money, and that flows back down through everyone. And so you're taking away a premium. The evidence behind the situation where we've ended up comes off the papers. It's based on largely one particular study. There are others to support it, which had to do with some Indian fumigators, but it's not supported, we believe, by good evidence that achieves the good outcomes that they're chasing. And to be honest, yeah, to give the government credit, and it's not, this is sort of by no means government bashing, is that a lot of the particulates we actually think they got very, very right. And, you know, we agree with some of those, but this one is wrong, and we're finding it really hard as an industry to find people that want to listen to the size of the problem and to find a way. And with the way that it's been implemented, and it's coming on the 1st of December, there's no clear process of appeal or a way to challenge it. And so we're getting bounced around federally to state and back and forth. And we just really need some help to go out and find a way to get someone to hear us. We're happy to do the work, to provide the evidence, to support our situation. And we really believe a regulatory decision should consider both the health and economic reality. And at the moment, we just don't think that's been done.
So after December 1, will it actually be feasible or practical for you to continue using phosphine?
Oh, look, of course, we're going to continue to do what we can do. What the exact cost float back to the grower in the end is difficult. But that the biggest, so the other question that comes out is that how the regulator or the enforcement agencies are actually going to approach it and police it. Like, if it can't measure it, how do you enforce it and how do you achieve it? Like, it's a sort of in a no-win situation. And that's a real concern. GrainCorp is, you know, and big companies like us are maybe a little bit fortunate, but you're talking ma-and-pa farming organisations that have to operate to the same level if we're asking them all to have individual phosphine monitors. And, you know, they need to be affordable, they need to be available, but they also need to be accurate. And so it's a real unknown, and it's a real concern, and it's a massive issue for the industry.
Josh Connell, Head of Supply Chains with GrainCorp, speaking with Angus Verley. Taking your thoughts on this afternoon, do you agree with these new phosphine maximum exposure limits? I wonder how much communication you've had, if you're a grain grower, about it and what these changes mean from December 1st. Let me know on text this afternoon, the number 0448 922 604. In a statement, a spokesperson for Safe Work Australia, which is the group introducing the changes, said these revised exposure limits reflect the current established state of knowledge as assessed by independent experts. They have been determined in accordance with the objective and methodology agreed by WHS ministers. that statement there from Safe Work Australia. Certainly one to watch, though, isn't it, with Victoria delaying those new phosphine rules by another 3 years, but in other states, they're due to come into effect on December 1st this year, so not far away. While we're talking grain, on tomorrow's Country Hour, you'll hear the latest five-year snapshot of the Australian grains industry. Now, it's a lot to get through in it, but one of the most impressive stats is the production average. So it's jumped from 50%, or it's jumped by 50% over the past 5 years. So it now sits at 64 million tonnes per annum.
Australia is a hostile farming environment. Our inputs are always expensive and have to be carefully managed. We've seen a no or low-till revolution over the years. We've seen lots of little changes, and this is not necessarily just in the last 10 years, but we've seen a revolution in how we farm over the last few decades, and now we're seeing the icing on the cake, which is improved genetics that let us grow more with the resources we have. And it's a really interesting point when people think back to previous generations. We sometimes have such limited moisture in the paddock and our grandparents couldn't even fathom planting a crop, yet we do plant a crop and sometimes they're really good. And we've actually seen five record years in the last six. So it has been a really positive growth period.
Tomorrow you'll hear more from Zach Whale from Grain Growers on what's driving that incredible growth in Australia's production average for grain, and also what farmers might need to think about for the coming next 5 years or so. That industry snapshot from Grain Growers on tomorrow's Country Hour. Well, mutton and overall numbers were up at this morning's sheep sale at Katanning. Just before one, Tracy Kilner will let you know what the prices were like. One to keep an ear out for. Just before one, heading off to the Katanning sheep sale. 21 past 12, a retired rural doctor has decided to dedicate a lot of her spare time to restoring a degraded wheatbelt woodland. After more than 3 decades of working at some of Australia's most remote communities, Dr. Susan Downs has found a 200 hectare or 500 acre in the old language property between York and Northam. It's called My Mackie.
It's remnant land, this. You know, when people hived all this off, the farmers around here didn't want the Mount Mackie hilly, rocky stuff. So 300 of my acres really are just hill and rock and remnant woodland. And, you know, that's not valuable land for farmers. So therefore it got hived off and I bought it.
And tell me about that purchase. It was part of a retirement plan. How did you end up in the Avon Valley?
I've only just really retired from medicine, but I haven't retired from anything else. Life is just as full as ever and I can't fit it all in. So I'm still a primary producer, you know, so I'm not retired. I'm a farmer now. I've just changed my things, although I'm still registered as a doctor. I found the place and I didn't really think about what I was going to do with 500 acres. And I really was going to dismiss the idea, saying this is crazy, this is absolutely crazy. But the agent that had gathered us all together that day said, look, well, you might as well look, we're all here, you might as well look at the back, right up the back, and have a look at the whole thing and don't make a decision yet. So he took us in a very rocky road up the back, and it was when I was up there, the high country in that remnant woodland, that I realised that for me it was a very spiritual place, and I was just drawn to this, the magic old ancient trees that were there and the Euro kangaroos that were there and everything. And I thought, oh gosh. And anyway, my heart took over my head and I bought it. But it's got a magic about it. And I was coming back from York one day and I saw a standing stone on the opposite side, on the right-hand side as you're coming back from York. But when I pulled in and had a look, there was the plaque on there and it said, you are looking at Mount Mackie from this point on the 7th of August, 1830. Ensign Dale, Robert Dale and Brockman climbed there, and from there was the first sighting by Europeans of the Avon Valley. And I thought, right, that's amazing. This is a very special place, and it must be a special place for Aboriginal people as well as European history. I just gradually got more and more drawn to it. Every time I went up there, I felt more inclined that this place needed to be preserved and improved and shared, really, with everybody else.
So tell me more about this restoration project, the Mount Mackie project you're now involved with.
Initially, when I first came here, which was 11 years ago now, and the local natural resource management people in the Wheat Belt in Northern had some projects that they were happy to include mine in, and I approached them and they gave me a small grant plus 24,000 trees. And so 5 years ago, we got a group together and somehow we planted 24,500 trees, which was an amazing, amazing effort. And it was because I've never done anything like this before in my life. I love gardening, but this is not a garden and this is not a gardening project. And I have to keep getting that out of my head. This is a huge project and I'm learning every day about it on how to do it. We started there and then at the end of that planting season, when we got all these plants in the ground, about 20 people came back to the house and we sat around outside and we had a lunch. We talked and I told them of my vision. I thanked everybody and I said, look, this is my vision. There's two basic things. One, I want to protect and conserve and rejuvenate this forest because 95 to 97, whatever the numbers are, of the wheat belt have been cleared for farming. So it's a very special place, along with all the other patches of remnant bushland around. And the second thing is because the 200th anniversary of Dale coming to Mount Mackie and viewing the Avon Valley will be on the 7th of August 2030, I wanted to acknowledge that that happened, that that was, you know, a heroic thing for first settlers, and he was only in his early 20s, but also the devastation that it caused to the Aboriginal people, the Noongar, Baladong, Noongar people of this area. So there were those two things. And from that group of 20, about eight people formed the core of Mount Mackie, Friends of Mount Mackie, and they still exist. But the volunteers around that have just grown and grown and grown. And we've now got at least 80, probably more. People from all ages, from like 7 to 80 or something, or 8 to 80. And we've got Intrepid Land Care that have adopted our place and they love coming here and want to do more. I've joined up with the Urban Bushland Council, Landcare Australia, Regen WA, and we're coming up to the Landcare Week. And I just realise that this is all expanding. There's no coercion. It's just expanding around me. And that sometimes it's quite frightening and overwhelming of how much is just rolling and developing amazingly. But it's all good. It's all good.
Dr. Susan Downes, AM, speaking to Olivia Thorne about her work to restore Mount Mackie, which is between York and Northam. 28 past 12. Let's head to the newsroom. Good afternoon, Jonathan Hopper.
Good afternoon, Joe. The WA Nationals are calling for more cooperation from the state government in the passing of the mandatory train lighting bill. Strobe lighting on trains was recommended 26 years ago by the coroner, who investigated the deaths of three West Australians when their car collided with a train in the Wheat Belt. Shane Love says while he believes the opposition and the government want the same outcome, the bill's progress is needlessly slow.
The Assistant Minister for Customs says five WA sites were among the more than 100 service stations raided by a nationwide illicit tobacco task force. WA Police and the Department of Health were part of the Tobacco National Disruption Group, which yesterday raided service stations thought to be dealing in illicit tobacco products. And the state government has announced it's provided $4 million to fund a price freeze on tickets for the Royal Show, as well as a 50% discount for early bird sales. Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis says with the early bird discount, a family of four can attend for less than $80. Entry for kids aged three and under remains free. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Jonathan. I can't believe that show season is upon us already. Again, feels like just the other day, but preparations underway. There's a couple of shows on this weekend. I think, is it Mullawar and Perenjori? I will double check that, but cannot believe it. That time of year again. Let's cross now, though, to the Bureau. Angeline Prasad. Angeline, should we start in the south of the state? How's it looking for the next few days?
Good afternoon, Joe. It's settled weather across the south. We've had this massive high pressure system come across, so just a little bit of cloud and a light shower along the south coast, but the high pressure system is bringing in the static weather pattern for the remainder of the week, so we'll see mostly clear days ahead, so a fair bit of sunshine, but also quite cold nights. So the last couple of nights have been quite cold across inland parts of the Southwest Land Division. We've seen temperatures dip below 5 degrees across most areas and inland parts of the Great Southern Central Wheat Belt, we've seen temperatures drop below zero. So quite cold through this area. So the main sort of feature heading into the weekend will be morning frosts and fog, and that's going to be quite extensive over the next couple of days. So if you see your temperatures the forecast temperature dip below 3 degrees, then there's chance of light frost. Below 1 or 0, then there's a bit more frost expected in the mornings across the wheat belt areas. No rain expected for the remainder of the week. The high pressure system is going to stick around until Sunday, where we do see it edging off to the east. Next week, we'll see another change in the weather pattern, where we will see a series of cold fronts come through. So this week, it's dry, it's become dry, it's sunny, but next week we'll go back into a frontal system pattern where we'll see at least three fronts come through. Early days yet, but we'll keep you informed of how much rainfall we're forecasting for those three fronts coming through. So the first one will be on Monday, and then potentially another one on Wednesday, followed by a third one next week, Friday.
Any idea, Angeline, how cold it could get over the next few days, particularly inland in the wheat belt?
Last night we saw temperatures in a few places drop to -1 and -2. With that high pressure ridge sticking around, it is going to mean that those cold nights will continue. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to be as bad as what we've experienced over the last couple of nights. So looking back, for example, tonight we'll still see a few areas dip below zero, especially across the western parts of the Great Southern and the Central Wheat Belt. And on Friday morning, it's going to be between 2 to 5 degrees. So we do see a gradual rise in those temperatures, overnight temperatures, but it's going to be gradual. So we'll still see a good amount of areas below zero potentially tonight. And then as the winds turn more east to northeasterly, especially on Friday into the weekend, those overnight temperatures will slowly climb, but, you know, still be single digits and most likely still below 5 degrees in most of these locations.
Okay, we'll cross our fingers. How's the north looking?
Pretty good as well. That ridge has brought in a cooler dry surge to the rest of the state, so quite windy through northern parts of the Gascoyne, the Pilbara, the interior, and even the southern Kimberley. That surge has made it past Halls Creek and further north. So cooler, drier under these southeasterly, sort of windy southeasterly conditions. But tomorrow morning's the last day of that surge. The surge does weaken off tomorrow morning, and we'll see an easterly wind return from later tomorrow. There is a weak trough across the northern parts of the Kimberley, and that trough will extend into the Pilbara tomorrow night. Consequently, we'll see a cloud band develop through the northern parts, over northern inland parts, so western Kimberley interior and even the far eastern Pilbara. This cloud band is going to bring unseasonal rains to these areas, so western Kimberley and mainly through the interior. We'll see generally light rainfall on Friday into Saturday. There's also a chance of thunderstorm activity through the interior as that cloud band evolves. So a bit of light rain, it'll feel unseasonal and it will be cooler underneath the cloud band as well. Some areas may see a little bit more rainfall, maybe moderate falls here and there, but generally on the lighter side, and we'll see that cloud band contract off to the east on Sunday.
Angeline, thank you. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
You too. Bye-bye.
Richard Hudson has all the rainfall details for the past 24 hours. Richard, what have we got?
Well, that was a bit of an exaggerated build-up because we don't have much at all.
It's trying to make you feel special.
Thank you. You do. Yeah, pretty rare. nothing in the north, but in the east, tiny bit around in the Eucla district. Eucla itself had 3 mils and Red Rocks 0.2. And then in the Southwest Land Division, you've got to go down to the southern coastal area. A few places had ones and twos. Above that, it was Albany and the Duke had 4 mils. Tallina Downs and Dalyellup Park had 5, but that's actually about it. Just repeating that news from the top of the show, there is a bushfire watch and act now in place in the Shire of Broome. So that's for people at Barn Hill Caravan Park and Barn Hill Station in parts of Roebuck. So that alert level has been upgraded because the authorities believe there is now a possible threat to lives and homes in the area. The fire's burning west of the Great Northern Highway. It's burning towards the Barn Hill Caravan Park. It's moving in a northwesterly direction, not contained or controlled, and firefighters and pastoralists are on the scene at the moment actively fighting that fire. If you need more details, just search emergency and WA and you will find the emergency WA website. The most serious warnings are at the very top. That one is at the top of the homepage, very easy to find. Also, some total fire bans in place today. City of Karratha has one and so does the town of Port Hedland. So when a total fire ban's in place, you know the rules. You can't light, maintain or use a fire in open air. You're not allowed to do anything that can actually start a fire. And if you don't know what that is, again, just search emergency in WA and you'll find the total fire bans. You'll find which shires have one in place. And you'll also be able to find out what you can and can't do.
How'd you go with your census last night? Did you get it done?
I found it infuriating, to be honest.
Was that because you had to say how much domestic labour you did? Because that's a big talking point.
It did actually surprise me that you did have to estimate those sorts of things. But one thing that surprised me today was I then got a text saying my MyGov security has detected unusual activity. You don't reckon that could be coincidental between what I was doing on census last night? I don't know. I just suspect it's an amazing, amazing coincidence. One of the questions I did like last night, though, is it asks you the questions with the name of whoever's with you. So for me, it was my daughter at the time. So it actually says, does your daughter ever need someone to help with or be with them for communication activities? And I'm going through the options going, yeah, where's the options for it? Needs to know how to find texts, needs to know how to answer her mobile phone. That wasn't one of the options, unfortunately.
No, because texting and calling is old-fashioned. You need to modernise your communication, I think.
Yeah, you need to get up to speed, Joe, like me, and get on Tic Tac.
Oh, dear. Richard, a rail safety bill is being debated this afternoon in the Legislative Assembly. What do you know about it?
Yeah, so the official title for this is the Rail Safety National Law Application Amendment, the Rolling Stock Lighting Bill 2026. So the leader of the Nationals, WA, Shane Love, has proposed this bill, which aims to strengthen the minimum lighting requirements on trains. So in a nutshell, it's calling for flashing beacons, side lighting and reflectors to be mandatory on trains and the rolling stock, etc. Now, one person who's played a crucial role in getting this issue debated is Lara Jensen, who's driven into Perth today from Wandanong Station, which is about 650 kilometres northeast of Perth, so in the Mount Magnet area. And she says, after 26 years of campaigning, today is a very special day.
It's incredibly significant for me, Richard. You know, this is not a political issue. It's a public safety issue, and it's one that has been flagged by coroners and parliamentary recommendations dating back to 1968 here in WA. That is the issue of inadequate train visibility and illumination. So, yeah, incredibly significant for us.
Is there likely to be an outcome at the end of this debate?
I'm not sure myself. I don't believe tomorrow will be the day. I believe that there could be further negotiations potentially. I just don't have any firm background on that one at this point.
What's your gut feel, though? Do you feel as though you have support of all the different sides?
I commend the Nationals and the Liberals for this strong alliance position. We actually haven't heard Minister Safiotti come out anyway or the other, really, or Roger Cook. So I really don't know how they're feeling about it, but we would like to think that we have their public support. Anyone who says that they support rail safety should support this rail safety bill.
And this morning you've had a show of support from various people, haven't you, including representatives from different farming groups in WA?
That's correct, yes. Yes, we've had the National Farmers Federation, WA Farmers, the Pastoralists and Graziers Association, and obviously we've got the backing of road transport groups as well that care about the safety of their members and want to see their members come home. We've also got, obviously, Malcolm McCusker, King's Council and Acting Council in WA. He's been very supportive. And Lee Kernahan, a country music legend, who's also a strong rural advocate.
As long as you've got him on side, anyway.
He's a good man.
On a serious note, though, some people seem to passionately disagree with the idea of increasing mandatory rail lighting. Why is that?
I think nobody is saying that the motorists don't have a responsibility to obey signage and to exercise extreme caution around railway level crossings. Nobody's disputing that. But what we are saying is that motorists who are approaching or stopped at a level crossing can't be expected to yield to an approaching train they can't even see. We are trying to make that hazard in land's largest vehicle, the train, visible at all times of the day and night to road users. We know that it isn't, and it has caused serious injury and deaths for more decades than I can count.
I'd just like to introduce Dr. Brett Hughes now, who has 45 years' experience as an engineer specialising in transport, both in policy planning and research of all modes of transport. Dr. Hughes, why do you think some people disagree with this? Do they actually have a fair point as to whether the mandatory requirements for lighting on trains is unproven?
The opposition to better train lighting and train visibility has actually been quite hard to unpick, and I've been trying to unpick it for more than 25 years. Some of it absolutely boils down to the cost, but we also know that the costs are reasonable for what we're trying to do and what the bill's proposing. I've heard many reasons over the years. There's not enough real estate on the train. There's not enough electrical power. They're too hard to fit. They're too hard to maintain. They interfere with the operations of the drivers. They're a distraction. They cause headaches. There's a whole range of reasons. All of those reasons have been proven to be false. And we've got examples of trains with better lighting throughout Australia in all sorts of different circumstances.
Lara, what are your thoughts, though, when you see some social media comments? And I know it's not a great platform to be debating something like this, but I know some people are simply saying things like, you're just simply trying to excuse driver error. How does that sit with you?
Oh, that's completely false too. And to be honest, that hurts. You know, my brother, Christian, was the most careful, conscientious 20-year-old driver that I knew. You know, he was someone who cared deeply about his safety and that of other people's. So do we. People like myself and Dr. Brett Hughes and all our supporting organisations. That is simply not true. We're not condoning reckless or risk-taking behaviour around level crossings, full stop. We are talking about an exhaustively documented visibility hazard in poorly lit trains. And you only have to read the research, particularly the last... there's been three national train lighting reports in the last 5 years now that have all proven increased train lighting improves their visibility, Richard. You know, it's all documented. And we've done extensive research, myself and Dr. Brett Hughes.
For those people who are not familiar with that accident that you're referring to, apologies to do this to you, but can you take us back to that tragic accident? What actually happened?
Okay, so my brother Christian was travelling with his two friends, Jess Broad and Hilary Smith, in his Land Cruiser ute. They were on their way to the Jenica Bayan Tavern to celebrate a 21st birthday for their friend, but they were struck and killed at the Yarramoney Level Road crossing on Dark. That particular crossing, Richard, was protected only by a give-way sign. There were no rumble strips, and the signage on approach to that particular crossing was not conspicuous to warn of a railway crossing, as the independent consultant who gave evidence at the inquest found a year later. It was also a notorious crossing that had claimed another life just 3 years prior, so four dead in 4 years at one crossing, and our families would have to wait a further 14 years before flashing lights were commissioned there by Main Roads WA. So everything that could have been wrong with that crossing was. The vegetation was overgrown on approach to it, and before George Smith, the father of Hilary, could get to the accident site the following morning, trees had been cut down and vegetation cleared on approach to it. So we knew that the crossing had legitimate safety issues around it.
Dr. Hughes, do you think that particular accident could have been prevented if what you're trying to implement now was present back then?
So railway level crossings are a complex interface between two modes of transport, which means multiple users, multiple regulators, multiple laws all trying to interface together. There's no simple solution. There's no silver bullets in road safety or in level crossing safety. So we can't actually point to just one thing, like upgrading to stop signs, upgrading to flashing lights and boom gates. Train visibility is an important part of safety for railway level crossings because it helps drivers approaching a crossing identify that there's a train coming. It helps drivers assess the speed of the train approaching, and it helps drivers assess the distance to a train, because we know typically drivers overestimate the distance to a train and underestimate its speed, and that's a tragic combination.
Lara, what do you think Christian would make of this 20-year-plus battle that you've fought?
I think he'd be pretty proud. He was someone who did care deeply about his own safety and that of other people's. And, you know, just months before he was killed, Richard, he installed warning signs on a series of dangerous bends on approach to our station homestead. So he was unusual for his age, let's just say that. And those two beautiful girls that were killed that night with Christian, they elected to be in that vehicle with him because he was known as being a safety-conscious driver. You know, there was no drugs, alcohol or speed involved in that crash whatsoever. They just did not see the train. And even the train driver on duty that night said he believes that Christian mistook the train for a tractor spraying in the paddocks in the distance. So that shows you that train was not clearly identifiable as such, as an oversized hazardous vehicle that pushed them for 700 metres before it could come to a complete stop. I mean, the horror for those train drivers on duty that night, for me, is incomprehensible. And for all of our families, you know, we were not only shattered by the loss of those three beautiful lives, but also the horror that those train drivers on duty faced, the first responders, the cleanup crews, everyone else that's impacted by these tragedies, and the communities that reeled, you know, are still reeling in some ways because of their loss. We couldn't afford to lose those three. We can't afford to lose anyone else to another level crossing crash.
As you know, just under 2 years ago, new road safety legislation was introduced in WA. Now, WA's P-plate drivers are banned from carrying more than one passenger in their first 6 months behind the wheel. Mm. Those new road rules are known as Tom's Law, and that's after Tom Saffiotti was killed with his 17-year-old friend. He was 15 at the time. That took just over 3 years of campaigning to get up and get legislated. Tom's mum is related to WA's Deputy Premier and Treasurer, Rita Saffiotti. How does that make you feel?
It's really not fair. I mean, we might be bereaved rural families from vote-scarce regions, Richard, but we have a right to safety. My brother wasn't a senator's son. We're not politically connected families, but we are families that care deeply about the safety of other people, and that's why we're still fighting, because I'm tired of the carnage, and my brother's crash was a completely preventable crash, and we don't want to see any more other families, you know, welcomed into this fraternity no one wants to belong to, which is our group of families, you know, from all over Australia, some of which are flying in to be with us today. So, you know, that's it in a nutshell. And just but to put it into context, I think, Richard, if I ignore a safety hazard on our cattle station and an employee is killed, I'm instantly liable for industrial manslaughter charges. There's no ifs, buts or maybes. That's exactly how it works when you're a primary producer on the land, when you have responsibilities for employees. And look at the rail industry. This issue of poor visibility has been exhaustively documented, not only by coroners but by parliamentary inquiries.
And Dr. Jones, what are your thoughts on just how fast that legislation came through with Tom's Law? Not to have a crack at the law itself.
I've been working on road safety for a long, long time and on rail safety for a fair part of that. And it always saddens me as a policy professional when certain issues aren't prioritised the way they should be. So without comparing one or the other, level crossing safety is a priority issue for railways. It's the greatest risk to human life in railways. That's not me saying that. That's the Office of the National Rail Safety Regulator. And yet governments seem to be reluctant and to take a long time to do anything. It doesn't sound logical to me. There's too much pushback and not enough reality. And it saddens me greatly.
Well, I'm sure both of you will be following the debate this afternoon, the rail safety bill debate, very closely, and also the outcome. But can I thank you very much for your time in the Country Hour today?
Thanks, Richard. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Rail safety advocate Lara Jensen from Wandanong Station, which is about 650 km northeast of Perth near Mount Magnet. And joining her was engineer Dr. Brett Hughes, who is an independent transport researcher and advocate.
Yeah, and that rail safety bill is going to be debated starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon in the Legislative Assembly. And the reason I emphasise the word starting is I don't expect this is going to be done and dusted in an hour with a resolution. The reason I say that is I have reached out to the RTBU, which is the Rail, Tram and Bus Industry Union. In a nutshell, they're also advocating for better safety around rail crossings. They want better train lighting, but they're worried about the wrong sort of lighting being legislated. They're worried about a few other things as well. But there are also some nuances some of us and some of the politicians may not be fully aware of with lighting and safety for trains and wagons in WA. So you'll hear from the union, the RTBU, in tomorrow's show.
Gosh, you'd think after 20 years of conversations, they would have straightened that out. Richard, thank you. And appropriate to have these conversations because we are currently in the middle of National Rail Safety Week and continuing, as Richard said, that conversation tomorrow.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. With interest rates on hold, a sigh of relief or a gasp of apprehension about further rate hikes ahead? How much economic pain can Australians take and can Labor turn the polls around in time? More than 169 killed and thousands still missing in Colombia as the race to find survivors in the rubble continues. And Phillip Island's famous fairy penguins will be some of the first to be vaccinated against the deadly H5 strain of bird flu. Join me for The World Today.
Heading towards the Katanning sheep sale shortly, but on Sunday night, 19-year-old Hervik de Clerador had a car accident that he will never forget. Travelling east towards Albany on the South Coast Highway, he came around a corner and worst nightmare material, crashed into 15 cows.
Well, there was a herd of 30 cows on the road that escaped from a farm somehow, and I ploughed straight into them with my car.
Good grief. Are you okay?
Yeah, I think so.
How fast were you going?
110, but it was around a corner, so I didn't see them in time.
At what point did you see the cows and realise what was going on?
Well, what happened was someone actually parked next to the cows because they saw the cows before me, like on the other side of the road facing towards me. And what they did was they turned on their high beams to try and warn me, but they didn't flash the high beams, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So obviously driving down the road, I think, oh, what a dickhead. He just leaving his high beams on. But as I got closer, I tried to flash him to try and turn it off. But when I flashed my own high beams, that's when I saw the cows. I was only 15 metres away from the cows, give or take. And then I didn't have time to brake. I just smashed right into them.
What was that moment like when you made contact with the cows?
Terrifying, to be honest. It just happened too fast. I was just driving normally and then everything exploded in my face and ringing in my ears and everything went black and there's airbags all over me.
Did you realise what had happened?
Not really, because the safety features on my car was insane. It's a 5-star ANCAP safety thing, but I didn't really feel the impact because the airbags just caught me so well that I thought that it was just going to be like a big dent or something. So I just thought, oh no, I have to fix my car. But then I grabbed my phone, stepped out to open my door to step out, but the door was really stiff, so I thought, oh my god, it's going to be big damage. Then I walked out, there was a cow on the ground, still alive, can't move, looking at me with tears in his eyes. And then I see my car, the whole bonnet is caved in, dented in, and just unrecognizable.
And any chance of repair of the car?
No, it's a total write-off.
And the cows themselves, what state were they in?
I hit 15 cows, and I think when I stepped out, there was immediately just 6 cows scattered around my car. Half of them were dead, but then half of them were still alive but limping, and the police came to go put them down.
That happened on site, did it? They were put down?
Yeah.
And what happened after that?
Well, when the police came, obviously they put down the cows, and then we got tow truck to get my car off the road. I went to hospital to get myself checked, but the police said that they went for another 20-minute search for any more cows and to see if there's any broken fences, but they couldn't find any cows or broken fences. But there was definitely way more cows than I hit.
Hervik de Clerador from Albany speaking to Peter Barr about that experience, hitting 15 cows on the South Coast Highway on the weekend. Hervik's only 19 and he only just got his car 2 weeks ago. It was a flash looking Isuzu four-wheel drive. I've seen a photo of it in the afters and it is well and truly a write-off, but I am very glad you are okay. What an experience. You're just hearing from Lara Jensen and Dr. Brett Hughes about a rail safety bill that's due to be debated in Parliament this afternoon. Some of your texts about this conversation of whether or not trains and their carriages should be lit up. Text in, every piece of machinery and even vehicles, etc., have to have flashing lights. So should trains. Just get on with it. What an absolute embarrassment in today's world. Unbelievable. All the excuses because of pig-headedness. That text from Anonymous, thank you for that. Just a reminder, if you can pop your name and your location on your text as well to us, please. Paul said road trains have side lights and reflective markers, so trains need them as well. And a text from Jason, this is a no-brainer, just put lights and reflectors on trains for goodness sake. Not only does an accident like the one spoken about in the story destroy the lives of those in the car, but it also devastates the lives of families and friends left behind and also affects the train drivers, first responders and emergency services attending. Come on, Pollies, pull your finger out. That text from Jason. Thank you for that text. Let's head to Katanning now. The sale numbers were up about 2,000 on last week. Final tally was 7,665. Tracy has all the details.
Limited numbers of extra heavyweight lambs sold to $321 a head, while trade and heavy lambs gained with processed demand. The lightweight lambs eased, except for Merino ewe lambs being sought by restockers, selling to $221 a head. Buyers discounted lambs with no dentition calls, seeing fluctuations in all weight categories. Mutton numbers increased with quality mixed, causing pricing to fluctuate. to finish firm to up with demand. Heavyweight ewes topped at $260 a head. The lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight sold from 85 to 172. Heavier merino ewe lambs sold at $216 a head. Trade weight lambs sold from 180 to 241. And the heavyweights under 24 kilos carcass weight made from 220 to 270. While extra heavyweights topped at $321 a head. Ram lambs gained selling to processors for $80 to $242 weight dependent. Merino store weather hoggets sold for $156 to $173. Heavyweights made from $203 to $210. The merino ewe hoggets sold from $140 for stores and up to $212 for the heavier prime weights. Store ewe mutton gained selling from $76 to $201 with a fleece. Prime medium weight ewes returned 162 to 223, while the heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from 210 to $260 a head. Mature store weathers returned $180, medium weight sold 210, and heavyweights returned 229 to $260. Mature rams sold from 100 to $220 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you. At the beginning of the program, you were hearing some concerns from the grains industry about changes to the amount of phosphine that can be used in stored grain. Chris at Beverley sent a text saying fumigant harmful to humans being used on grains, some of which will be ultimately used for human consumption. Join the dots and find an organic or non-toxic alternative to phosphine. But 3 months' notice for the change is unreasonable, so the suggestion of a 3-year deadline sounds more feasible. Thank you for that text in, Chris, and for all your messages that I didn't get to this afternoon. It is good to hear from you. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.